who is Søren Schlichting from Bielefeld University, and he will speak about quark gluon plasma thermalization. However, first, a short introduction. Søren was educated in Germany and the United States in Darmstadt University and Michigan State University, and then continued his career in Heidelberg, and worked also in Brookhaven National Laboratory, and not just now is a junior professor in Bielefeld. He is the winner of the Zimany Medal in this year. That is one of the important reasons of his invitations. And for that, what is Zimany Medal and why is it interesting for our institute? We'll speak Peter Levai and ask him to introduce.
Thank you, Peter. So just very shortly, because we did never had any introduction of the Zimany Medal and the audience possibly is interested. Søren knows about it because he was awarded. So the main point that after the pass of Jozsef Zimany, we established together with the Laurent Eötvös Physical Society, we established the Zimany Medal, and there is the Zimany Foundation. Tamás Bíró is the president of the chairman of the Zimany Foundation, and this is one of the prize. There is other activity, or hopefully it should be. So this prize, just honoring Jozsef Zimany, just a few lines about his activity, and the Zimany Medal was established in 2011. And after that, in every quark matter conferences has been awarded. There is a, so the Zimany Medal rules that the medal is awarded to an outstanding young researcher working in heavy ion physics theory. The research field is understood as generously wide, but it is oriented on Jozsef Zimany's life work. No distinction, neither positive nor negative, can be made on the ground of race, gender, and nationality. As you see, we were very progressive already in 2011, and we try to keep this. So there is a so the age limit is 39, and every quark matter conference the medal is awarded. This was the selection committee for the Krakow quark matter, and here you can see the this is it, the previous winners. So Tetsufumi Hirano, Peter Petrecki, Tomas Lappi, Chihiro Sasaki, Björn Schenke, Hanna Peterson, and Alexi Kurkela. And Søren is just listed up to here. And this was the latest selection committee. There is a rule how to nominate people, young candidate, and voting, shortlist, finalist, winner. It is a very nice democratic process, and every time our the award winners are really looking forward for a nice career, but I wish also for you. Søren is, this is shortly what Peter already mentioned. I think it is no question that you earned this medal. Congratulations. And this was your main accomplishments: turbulent thermalization process, chiral magnetic effects, plasma kinetic description of heavy ion collision, and other interesting fields. And this is just to show you that, first of all, there is a certificate, which is signed usually by Tamás and Bert Müller, and there is a fee, what is the nice word of this? So a price, a check. I would say also about $2,000, which is not negligible. So, and thanks to Gergely Zimany, who is helping to award this check also. So we are looking forward for the next quark matter, which will be next year in Houston in the fall. So again, the committee will come together soon and we will find the next award winners. And now it is also my pleasure, and I am really happy that you accepted our invitation, and please, looking forward for your talk.
Yeah. So while we put up the slides, let me thank Peter for the for the nice introduction and for the kind invitation here to Budapest. It's really my first time in Hungary. Very pleasant, very great pleasure to visit. So what I'll do today is that I will try to, in the next hour or so, give you, I'll continue speaking while you put this up. I'll try to give you a little bit of a tour or a little view into some of the exciting non-equilibrium physics that's going on in high energy, heavy ion collision experiments. And since I'm expecting a rather sort of general audience that's not necessarily familiar with the details of heavy ion collisions, I'll start very general with a brief, this is the pointer, I guess, Matt, with a brief motivation and introduction. We will then talk about very generally about how thermalization, non-equilibrium dynamics, what kind of features can occur in systems like QCD, which are fundamental theories of nature. And then we'll turn back to actually sort of more modern and things that really have been worrying about more in recent years, is now that we believe that we start to understand something, we would like to see this in experiment, and we want to figure out how to do this. Okay, so let's start with sort of the bird's eye perspective, and let's first ask ourselves, why are we doing this? Why is it interesting to study heavy ion collisions at all? And somehow our overarching science goal in this case is really to understand the structure and dynamics of very fundamental constituents of matter. Yeah, so looking at this example of a helium balloon, of course, we all know that this is made up of helium atoms, which themselves consist of an outer electron shell and then the nuclear core, where we have protons and neutrons. So these are already incredibly tiny objects, right? But then we know that these are also not fundamental constituents of matter, but they themselves are made up of composite objects, of quarks and gluons. And for all we know, these quarks and gluons really could be fundamental particles, in the sense that they could be indivisible up to all energy scales. There's nothing theoretically that speaks against it. Yeah? So for all we know today, at least for part of the theory of part of nature that we're describing, quarks and gluons are fundamental constituents of matter. Okay, good. So then question comes about how can we probe these really tiny scale objects and learn about how they interact, how they behave, how they move around perhaps. And this is not that easy, because the way that they exist in nature is not that they roam around freely, but the interaction, so the so-called strong interaction that binds these objects, is actually so strong that in nature, under normal conditions, quarks and gluons always appear as bound objects, forming particles like the proton, the neutron, but also other excitations like the pion or the kaon. So as an example, you can see here, there's three quarks and some gluons being bound together. And I guess this could be a proton or neutron. And so we need since these objects are always confined, they're always bound into neutral objects, we need very extreme conditions to actually see or get a handle at these objects. Now, how can we do this? And essentially, there's sort of two directions that you can explore. One of them is that, you take an object like the proton or the neutron and probe it with a very, 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 very high resolution, right? So this is like the analog of doing microscopy, right? But just doing microscopy here at extreme scales, so that we can access these subnuclear scales. In this case, we cannot really do this with optical light, simply because we don't have a small enough wavelength there. So instead of doing that, one probes it with other elementary particles. So one example, what one can do is one can shoot an electron onto a proton or a nucleus and thereby try to scatter off the internal constituents of this object. Yeah. The same can also be achieved this would be an experiment that's called deep inelastic scattering. These have been performed, I guess, in the 90s or so extensively at the Hera Collider in Germany. And there's plans to really push this frontier also further in the upcoming 10 years with the building of an electron ion collider in the United States. Of course, you don't have to do this with leptons. You can also do this with a proton, scattering of a proton itself. In this case, you would sort of hope that that one of the constituents of the proton would scatter off another one. And these are really, so these are really precision scattering experiments, like you would do them to probe, say, a material in condensed matter physics, right? To learn about what is inside these objects, namely what is the spatial and momentum distribution of quarks and gluons inside a hadron. The thing that happens though is that as you actually scatter off these objects, you cannot really knock out one of them, but instead this property of confinement, so things being bound together, actually takes place also under this environment. So you will never be able to just knock out a single quark. Okay, so but what will end up happening is that one will continue to produce them in additional bound states. So to really kind of, so this is a little bit like, right, so you can look at the animal in the zoo, right, but it's still behind the fence, right? So what we would like to do is we would actually like to observe these guys in free nature and pull them out of their fence. And there, the only way to do this is not to go to high resolution, but instead go to very, very high energy density, okay? So since at low temperatures, quarks and gluons are always confined, we need some other mechanism to make the fundamental constituents visible. And the idea that you can follow is to go to take nuclear matter, so to take, for instance, atomic nuclei, or let's say that, right? And just heat them up to incredibly high temperatures. So what happens when you do that? Well, so in our normal world, okay, we would have nucleons flying around as bound objects. But then if you either heat up the system, or the other way to do this is to compress the system, okay, what will happen is essentially that you'll have more and more bound states in a small fixed volume, okay, so that at some point essentially these bound states can start to overlap, okay, and well, when that happens, essentially a single constituent will no longer know whether or not it will belong to one or another bound state. Okay, so if you continue this long enough, essentially the way this will look like is that essentially your constituents, the quarks and the gluons, can start to roam around freely in the soup. Okay, and that's in analogy. So this is similar to what if you were to take atoms and fully ionize this. You form a state where the charged particles roam around freely, and in this case, this consists of quarks and gluons, and is in a plasma phase. Okay, so this is what is then the state that's called a quark gluon plasma. Okay, now this is sort of the cartoon version of this, right? So the question is then, well, what are the type of temperatures that you need to achieve this? And this is something that actually, because in this situation, in this case, we're in the very lucky situation that we know the underlying microscopic theory that describes this, okay? And it turns out that every static property of the system we can calculate from first principles by putting this theory on a computer and solving this, okay? This is an endeavor called Lattice QCD. This is in Bielefeld. We are very big in doing this, but also here, okay? And I would say over the course of the last, well, probably like 20 years or so, there's been really major progress in sort of trying to calculate the temperature at which this transition happens from a system of having bound quarks and gluons to the quark gluon plasma. Okay, and this is what is depicted over here on the right. So what you can look like is essentially you can just count. You can look at thermodynamic properties of your system, count how many degrees of freedoms do you have in the plasma. Well, if they are bounded to hadrons, the number of degrees of freedom is smaller than if you count them individually, the constituents. And this is exactly what you see. So looking at these curves, you see a rapid rise of the number of degrees of freedom around this temperature here of something like 150 MeV. And then as you go very, very high in temperature, you slowly approach the limit of having non-interacting quarks and gluons. So really like a gaseous phase of these particles. Now you may ask what the temperature here is that you need to do this, and it turns out this temperature is very, very high. Okay, so in natural units, it turns out to be around 155 mega electron volt. If you convert this to Kelvin, this is something like 10 to the 12 Kelvin. And this is something like more than a million times the temperature in the center of the sun. Okay, so obviously this is nothing that you can kind of do in a tabletop experiment in your little lab here to create these conditions. One place where something like this was realized is, we believe that it was realized, was very early on in the early universe, about microseconds after the Big Bang. Huh? So this is also where matter was in a state that looked like this. Now, of course, we only have one universe and it's not so easy to look that far back, right? So we need to think harder on how we can actually prove this. And so the only way to recreate these conditions on Earth is to study collisions of heavy ions. So what one takes is heavy nuclei such as gold or lead. And the idea is then to basically smash them into each other, convert their energy into internal energy of the, so their kinetic energy into internal energy of the plasma, right? And thereby create such a high energy that that these enormous temperatures can be reached. And so, these experiments are being performed, among other places, at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, and the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider, which is a dedicated machine for this physics at Brookhaven. And what they do is they take heavy nuclei, accelerate them up to 200 times their rest mass in the case of RIC, 5,000 times their rest mass in the case of the LHC, so enormous energies here. And they are then collided head on, okay, to produce this extremely hot state, but this state only persists for a very, very short duration of time, which is, we believe, is something on the order of 10 to the minus 24 seconds, okay? So this is a very, very violent experiment somehow, right? We don't, in that sense, have very, very good experimental control over this also, right? I mean, there's no measurement you can perform on this time scale, okay? So essentially, the only thing that you can really control in this experiment is what species of nuclei you collide and at what energy you collide them, okay? But with that, you can actually already do a lot, yeah? So for instance, if you look at a diagram of the conjectured phases of nuclear matter. So I explained to you, as you heat up the temperature, hadrons will transition to a quark gluon plasma. Now, if you make your system denser by kind of compressing nuclei, this is something that happens at lower energies. There's also other phases that are speculated and that play, for example, a role in neutron stars. So this is kind of matter versus antimatter asymmetry to some extent. What you see is that if you study different collisions, for instance, by changing the energy, you can increase the temperature of the system and you end up with a smaller imbalance of matter over antimatter. And in this way, you can sort of, if you go to high enough energies, really penetrate into this quark gluon plasma phase. Now, this sounds relatively nice, so we can sort of create these conditions. But what do we do with this? So what does this actually look like if we perform the experiment? And I already told you, we don't really have such a great control over what we do, but how we perform measurements on this system, because really the only thing that we can measure is the final outcome of a heavy ion collision. Yeah? So we cannot do time-resolved measurements. We can only look at the final outcome, and the final outcome looks something like this. So this is a picture of an event display at a of the CMX experiment at CERN. And what you can see here is that every line in this picture corresponds to one particle being produced in the collision. And these are kind of energy deposition in different calorimeters. And the reason I'm showing these pictures is that, okay, it's really not that easy to learn about, I mean, the goal is to learn about fundamental properties of nuclear matter here under extreme conditions, right? But looking at this very complicated mess, we don't really directly see that. So in order to actually be able to learn something, we really have to understand extremely well what is going on over the course of this collision. So how do we do that? And well, I told you, we know the underlying microscopic theory, which is QCD. I'll say a few words about that in the following. But the problem is QCD is complicated. This is a complicated reaction, okay? And we are simply not able and probably in foreseeable time, we'll never be able to directly describe these reactions from the microscopic theory of QCD. Okay. So instead, the way that the dynamics is described usually is that we instead use a hierarchy of different effective theories of QCD, which, well, phenomenologically work well to describe the dynamics of heavy ion inclusion. And so the way that we then typically picture these reactions is that at the very beginning, we start by colliding atomic nuclei, which are highly Lorentz contracted. As they collide, they pass through each other. They deposit this enormous amount of energy, but they actually kind of like mostly fly through and leave this very hot blob in the middle, which is initially terribly excited. And like, I mean, this is a very violent reaction. So you imagine a system being far from equilibrium here. The system is then believed to thermalize, or roughly thermalize, on a time scale on the order of 1 femtometer divided by the speed of light, so an incredibly short time scale, whereafter we can describe the dynamics of the system using relativistic viscous hydrodynamics. Yeah. And so what the system will do is it will expand into empty space, first along the sort of behind the colliding nuclei, later on also in the transverse expression. And by expanding into the vacuum, the system cools until at some point our temperatures are no longer high enough to sustain this hot plasma phase, but things somehow start to recombine into hadrons, so into QCD bound states, okay? These also then reinteract a little bit, okay, until eventually the system becomes diluted enough and free streams into the detector. Yeah? And this is only really the only place we can measure. Yeah? So this all sounds very complicated, but it turns out this really does a phenomenal job in describing the physics of heavy ion collisions, okay? And so sort of the parade example, so the parade example for this, so you may ask, how do I learn something here from all of this now? The parade example for this is the phenomenon of collective flow, okay? So if you look at the outcome of a heavy ion collision, this is kind of the picture I showed you before. How do you infer information now? Well, you look at the statistical properties of particles that are being produced, right? So for instance, what you can do is you can, so the beam comes in here and they come in here. So you can measure the angular distribution with respect, so the azimuthal angle with respect to the beam axis. And what you will find is that if you look at this kind of on an event by event basis, this is not somehow isotropic, right? But it shows these rather pronounced modulations of the spectrum, okay? And this is actually very analogous to the physics that you have in when you study, for instance, the cosmic microwave background, right? So if you look at the cosmic microwave background, this tells you about the expansion dynamics of the early universe, okay? And very analogous to that, okay, these kind of modulations, these angular variations that we see contain information about the expansion dynamics of the quark gluon plasma that we had created in the early stages of these collisions. And so the way that this is really a phenomenon that's very naturally understood in terms of this, what I call the standard model of the space-time dynamics, is how you produce this collective flow. So the way this works together and is that when these two nuclei collide, then typically they will deposit energy in the region that they overlap, right? But on an individual sort of collision by collision level, right? You have positions of nucleons that fluctuate. And so you will typically get an energy density profile, which looks like this, if you look at kind of the direction that the beam flies, with all kinds of hot spots and cold spots and highly excited matter here. Now, this system will expand into empty space and will do so hydrodynamically. So what that means is that in the directions where you have larger gradients, right, the expansion is driven by gradients of the pressure. And so this initial spatial anisotropy that you have is then translated into anisotropies of the fluid motion, which ultimately, as the fluid becomes particles, translates into the anisotropies that you can observe in the particles that you see in the experiment. Now, as in the cosmic microwave background, the way how efficiently this is translated depends on the properties of the expanding medium, right? And so you can immediately picture that if this medium is very viscous, so if it expands like honey, for instance, right, then this all the little structures will be washed out, okay, and you will end up with a sort of a more or less flat spectrum. But if this expands very well with very little resistance, then you will essentially get an imprint of every little wiggle. And so kind of by by, for instance, so by then looking at what you measure in the data and performing a statistical analysis, you can then learn about properties of the quark gluon plasma. And so one of the kind of striking key findings that's always quoted in this context is that actually the quark gluon plasma turns out to be a very good liquid in the sense that it expands with very, very little resistance. Namely, in particular, it has a ratio of the shear viscosity to the entropy. So this is really a measure of the resistance to expansion, which is very, very small. I believe it's actually the smallest known in nature. Okay. Now, there's one big caveat here, or one sort of big question, is that despite the fact that we have this sort of very, very successful phenomenology, and we can really, you can describe sort of 99% of all of the data that comes out from heavy ion collisions using hydrodynamic models, okay? But stated in brief, up till perhaps a few years ago, we didn't really know why, okay? Or perhaps in some cases, we still don't really know why, okay? Because in a sense, it's puzzling, right? You have this very violent reaction, right? You create this highly excited state of matter, right? It makes boom, okay? And then you're saying, okay, well, I can describe this very violent reaction shortly after by the calm of a fluid, okay? So the question that I'd like to spend the rest of the time talking about is, how does it actually come that we can treat the quark gluon plasma as a viscous fluid, namely describe it in terms of its macroscopic properties very shortly after the collision? And how is this liquid born out of the quote unquote primordial plasma, right? That is directly there after the collision of heavy nuclei. Now, this is an interesting question, not only coming from heavy ion phenomenology, right? But what we're touching upon here is, you know, sort of how does equilibration take place in fundamental theories of nature, so to say, yeah? And I already mentioned the connection in the early universe with the early universe, right? Of course, this was also a question that at some point our early universe had to pose us, namely, how did I actually create the standard model matter that we are all made of and that is all everywhere in the universe, okay? Out of sometime between the end of inflation and before Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Now, this is a much more complicated question because we don't really know the particle content at this scale, okay? But structurally, what we know is that at least the standard model particles have to be there. So naturally, what I'm about to tell you will also have some ramifications in this area. Okay, so with that, let me move on and tell you a little bit more about equilibration of QCD plasmas. And just to give a little bit more context, let me tell you a little bit first more about the theory of the strong interactions and the theoretical tools, the theoretical methods that we use here to describe this. So the microscopic theory of the strong interactions is quantum chromodynamics. You can easily write down the Lagrangian, but it doesn't matter what it looks like. The point is, what are the degrees of freedom that we have here? We have self-interacting gauge bosons, which are masses, and then we have different heavy and light flavor of Dirac fermions. And so if you just draw perturbatively the interactions, you have interactions between these lines are the gluons, and you have interactions between quarks and gluons. Okay, so this is what you have at the microscopic level if you just look at this theory. Now, the catch is that, okay, I already told you this forms bound states and so forth. And indeed, this theory is very, very complicated, very, very rich in the structure, which all can be tied to essentially the fact that the force carriers interact with themselves, okay? And so it really is displays non-perturbative features such as confinement, so the formation of bound states and also spontaneous breaking of different symmetries. If you look at the theory at low energy scales, so in low energy scales here means roughly a GeV. However, if you look at QCD or nuclear matter at very, very high energies, so with very high resolution, then this interaction actually becomes weak, okay? And the theory is asymptotically free. This was the Nobel Prize to Gross, Wilczek, and Bulitzer, right? Good. Okay, so this is the theory we're dealing with, okay? But it has non-perturbative features, but we could perhaps treat it using weak coupling methods at high energy. But this is not all of it, okay? Because the problem that we are asking is actually very complicated, okay? We're asking about a problem of sort of non-equilibrium evolution, real-time dynamics in an interacting quantum field, okay? And this is generally hard, okay? So there's in essentially no systems, you can, no quantum field theory, you can solve a problem for interacting non-equilibrium dynamics. Okay, so necessarily what I'm going to be able to tell you will rely on kind of some sort of approximation. Okay, and in the context of high energy QCD, there are essentially two limits where this is feasible. Okay, one of them is using strong coupling theories, which are not QCD. I'm not going to mention this any further. What instead I will do here is I will stick to the grounds of QCD, but pretend that the theory is weakly coupled, okay, and thereby try to go as far as I can. Now, of course, when I tie this back, so it actually scales of the early universe, this may not even be such a terrible idea, okay? But if I tie this back to heavy ion collisions, of course, I will have to sort of boldly extrapolate these findings, because there we know the typical coupling strength is of order unity, okay? But it turns out this is a more or less reasonable extrapolation, okay? At least things don't completely go crazy. Okay, so how does the QCD or dynamics in QCD look like if you look at the system at weak coupling? And at weak coupling, you see really the microscopic constituents of QCD. You have quarks and gluons, and you describe their dynamics as that of interacting particles, okay? Like, you know, perhaps you know in from non-equilibrium statistical mechanics, you can think of this as sort of like interacting billiard balls as described by the relativistic Boltzmann equation for QCD. Yeah? So these can kind of fly around and they can interact with each other. And this equation, really, you could write this down for, say, only condensed matter system or so, okay? But what makes this in unique to QCD are essentially two features. On the one hand, you have ultra relativistic massless quasi particles, okay? And the other thing is in the properties that they interact, which is the fact that on the one hand, you have kind of elastic 2-to-2 scatterings between the constituents, okay? But on the other hand, you also have radiative emission, like essentially something like QCD Bremsstrahlung, okay? Which appears at the same order in the weak coupling expansion, okay? And this is really something that's unique to non-abelian gauge theories such as QCD, or also in principle the electroweak sector of the standard model, okay, which really makes this somewhat special, and perhaps, and it also gives rise to different thermalization patterns than you would observe, say, in a generic condensed matter experiment, okay. And this theory was actually developed the leading order theory was written down for almost 20 years ago from today. In fact, now this is written down to next to leading order always already. But really where we've gained a lot of understanding in recent years is by now being able to kind of perform simulations and solve these equations numerically to really gain our understanding. Okay, so how do these kind of systems then thermalize? And let's first look at this kind of from a very, very general point of view. So, because it turns out to be really interesting, because of these particular features of the interactions, okay, these non-abelian gauge theories such as QCD, they feature two very distinct types of thermalization patterns. Yeah, and if you limit yourself to kind of systems which are not already close to equilibrium and will just relax back, okay, then you can essentially distinguish two situations of how you can put your system away from equilibrium. So one of them could be you take your system and you populate it with a very, very high number of low energy particles such that the typical energy per particle would be much less than equilibrium. So you have a very large density of low energy particles in your system, okay? So if you draw the density of particles as a function of the momentum, everything would be sitting here, whereas in equilibrium, kind of everything would be carried by excitations on the order of the temperature. And the way that such a system evolves is that these particles, they will undergo elastic scatterings whereby they gain energy, but they will also exhibit this kind of the inverse radiative process, so kind of mergings of two hard particles to form an even harder one, okay? And very, very quickly, you will actually lose detailed information about what your initial state was, and there will be kind of a continuous transport of the energy from your initial momentum scale all the way to the temperature. So in this case, this dynamics actually very, very closely resembles that of turbulence that you have. So this would be an ultraviolet cascade. So it's a very similar phenomenon to if you were to take a pot of water and stir it, right? And you would create this large scale eddies, which would sort of cascade into smaller and smaller eddies. So kind of transporting energy from the infrared to the ultraviolet, okay? And this is in QCD, this is actually also described by kind of turbulent scaling phenomena. The other example, so this is something that you can find rather generically in many systems. I already quoted turbulence of capillary waves as sort of a similar thermalization or as a similar dynamical pattern. The other case, or the opposite case, that you can consider is that instead of having a very high density of low energy particles, you can say, well, what happens if I just have very, very few but very highly energetic particles, which is also very far from equilibrium, right? So an example from the context of QCD is you just look at a bunch of high energy, very highly energetic jets, and you ask how do these guys thermalize, okay? And so in this case, you really see the unique nature of QCD, because this is a thermalization process that is driven by the emission of radiation, okay? So what happens is if you have a few very, very high energy particles sitting here, okay, is that they will start to interact with each other, but then by each interaction, you can emit radiation. And this radiation can be reasonably energetic, but it can also be very, very soft. Yeah, you can have like you have very, very soft Bremsstrahlung, okay? And so essentially what will happen is that these guys will emit very, very soft, gluons and quarks, okay? Which then, of course, soft particles are much more affected by interaction, right? If you slow, then little kick gives you more deflection, okay? So these will actually accumulate here and thermalize quickly. And then what happens is that eventually these soft particles, they take over. So the interaction is mostly between the hard particles and the soft particles until eventually kind of the hard particle splits and splits and splits and splits in kind of more or less democratic fashion, and thereby deposits all of its energy into the thermal bars, and then kind of all your hard particles are gone, and this is how the system thermalizes. And so this is kind of the cartoon version of two fundamental patterns of thermalization. So the progress that's now been made is that we can kind of go from the cartoon that I showed you earlier here to actual calculations, and so this is now an actual calculation using a QCD kinetic simulation, right? And what you can see is essentially exactly the pattern that I described. So here you, in the case of an overoccupied system, you start with some momentum distribution. Very quickly, you forget its form, and then kind of you have this continuous flow of energy towards the temperature scale. In the case where you have a hard particle, what you see is you see a characteristic spectrum of radiative emissions, a soft sector starting to build up and thermalize until eventually your particles, your hard particles are completely absorbed by the soft medium that they have actually themselves created. Okay, so this is, if you're familiar with the context, this is a little bit like jet quenching in QCD, except that it's actually the jets that thermalize themselves. Okay, so this is still somehow very, very, very generic patterns that we can see in QCD. So now let's come back to how this affects the evolution in heavy ion collisions, or how this applies to something that goes on in the real world and not just in our mind, okay? And for that, let me first say so you may ask now the question, okay, you've looked at this overoccupied and this underoccupied system, which is the one that's relevant for heavy ion collisions, right? And the answer is, of course, neither, okay? Because the situation is just a little bit more complicated, okay? So if we zoom into this kind of very early stages of a heavy ion collisions, then what we have is at the beginning, we have these colliding nuclei, which are highly Lorentz contracted, okay? And then as they pass through each other, so this is now they're moving apart, they deposit a lot of energy, mostly in the form of QCD radiation, so producing a gluon-dominated far from equilibrium initial state. Okay, and this is in principle something that you can calculate with effective theories of high energy QCD, what the state looks like. Okay, so you just have to essentially calculate the physics of hard scatterings of these initial particles. Okay, now what is special about this is, so initially this state is actually very highly occupied, so we have rather many low energy particles in the system. But what is different now in the situation that is, of course, as these nuclei move apart at almost the speed of light, right, that the plasma that you have created behind it also expands very, very strongly into the longitudinal, so into the beam direction. Uh-huh. So if you look at sort of a little bit of blob of plasma here in the middle, say in the middle of the colliding nuclei, then this little box will kind of expand very rapidly into along the longitudinal direction, okay? And this will, of course, make the system highly, highly anisotropic, right? Another way of saying this is if you look at a little box here in the middle, then you look at sort of highly energetic particles will move fast into either of the two directions. They will very, very quickly escape your box. Okay, so the thing that really drives this in a heavy ion collision or makes this slightly different is the fact that we're dealing with a system which is not only far from equilibrium, but it's also rapidly expanding and thereby typically highly anisotropic. Okay, and so one of the key question is then to understand how isotropy of the system is also restored and how this kind of changes the dynamics. So if you look at that, and so now I can no longer present you sort of nice 2D plots, but we can kind of try to understand what's going looking at this is essentially a similar mechanism that took place for the underoccupied plasma. So if you look at the phase space density, so these are now kind of contours of the phase space density as a function of the longitudinal momentum here and the transverse momentum here, then as your fast moving particles escape, you will very quickly end up with a situation where the typical transverse momenta are much larger than the typical longitudinal momenta. Okay, and so the energy is mostly carried by these kind of particles with a relatively high transverse moment. Okay, now in principle you could ask yourself, okay, how does such a system isotropize? Well, I just need to scatter them and kind of redistribute particles around. This is kind of generically the idea you would have, okay, but it turns out that this process is actually not efficient. If this was the only process, this would actually never isotropize. So what happens instead is that these elastic interactions, they are too inefficient to restore isotropy. So initially the system actually starts to become even slightly more anisotropic. Okay. But then at the same time, all these interactions also trigger, as we've seen before, the emission of radiation. And so what will happen is that very quickly your density of hard particles gets depleted, but they emit this soft radiation here, which is very collinear to the original particles. And thereby they start to produce a soft sector where the interactions are stronger and the system can actually thermalize and remain isotropic. Okay. And so what happens at the end of the day is that you create more and more soft radiation, you establish this thermalized soft sector until eventually, you know, really your hard particles, they undergo a few branchings into two, deposit all their energy into the soft sector. And this is really the microscopic, again, this unique microscopic equilibration pattern of QCD or QCD-like plasmas, which we call the bottom-up thermalization. Okay, so much about the microscopics. Now, the question that we set out to answer is, okay, how does this relate to macroscopic properties of the plasma? We want to describe such a system using hydrodynamics, okay? So let's talk about that. What does that mean, okay? So first of all, well, before one asks, does this apply or not, one should talk about what the beast is, right? So what is hydrodynamics, okay? So hydrodynamics is based on a principle that we don't doubt, which is energy momentum conservation, okay? But then the way the theory is developed is that it is energy momentum conservation alone doesn't, you know, describe the whole world. Okay, you need additional assumptions. Okay, and the way that the theory is developed is that it's based on an expansion around local thermal equilibrium. Okay, and there are essentially two expansion parameters that you can define. One of them is essentially something like a ratio of a mean free pass to gradients in the system. Okay, so in other words, if I'm a particle, do I kind of rapidly experience new conditions or do I scatter a few times before really my environment changes, okay? And the other one is just simply how far is the system away from equilibrium? So how far are non-equilibrium corrections to my energy momentum tensor compared to the corresponding energy momentum tensor in equilibrium. Okay, and that's something that's very easy to quantify, in particular for this system early on in a heavy ion collision, because I told you, okay, initially the system is very, very anisotropic. Okay, so what that means is that the pressure in the longitudinal direction is much smaller than the pressure in the transverse direction. And so really the key question in this case is, you know, how is isotropy restored in the system at the level of the different, the pressure in the different directions in the system. Okay, of course, if you have, I mean, if you have the microscopic information at hand, right, you can just simply calculate what the evolution of the pressure is in your system. And this really bears some interesting surprises. Okay. So shown here in the lower panel are the different components of the energy momentum tensor. So we have the energy density, the pressure in the transverse direction, and the pressure in the longitudinal direction. These are normalized such that at asymptotic times, the system would be isotropic and they would all kind of go to unity. Okay. And so the different colored lines here show you now results from thermalization in QCD kinetic theory. And the first thing you can do is that, so here we actually did this exercise where we varied the coupling strings, right? I told you we'll eventually have to extrapolate this to rather strong coupling. But the surprising thing that you find is that if you vary the coupling strings, okay, but you look at this in time or in times in units of the equilibrium relaxation time of the system, which is determined by temperature and viscosity of the system, then what you will find is that actually you can, I mean, these curves don't look any different. There is actually no dependence on the coupling here. Yeah. Okay. So the first lesson that, and there's of course physics behind this, right? Which tells you that even though the system is actually far from equilibrium, once you go to a halfway realistic coupling strength, really the equilibration is controlled by a single relaxation rate, so like single time scale, okay, which is given by an equilibrium relaxation rate, okay, that is defined like that. Now, the next thing that is really striking about this is if you ask yourself now, okay, how does this compare to what we would happen if you describe the system hydrodynamically, right? And I told you hydrodynamics is an expansion where we are supposed to be close to equilibrium. In equilibrium, I told you all of these things are equal, okay? But now, and this is if the system was in equilibrium. But now the theory of hydrodynamics is actually more, okay? If you go to the theory of viscous hydrodynamics, not only do you describe equilibrium systems, but you account for non-equilibrium corrections, okay? In the sense that you can actually describe the equilibration of your system hydrodynamically. And that's what's indicated by these dashed lines here, okay? Which show you the predictions from a second order theory of hydrodynamics. Yeah. No, this is not. No, I told you this is normalized such that. So this is normalized by a decaying function of time, so to say. Okay. So by the pressure in the corresponding equilibrium system here. Yeah. Thanks for the question. Yeah. So what you can do is you can compare this to the corresponding results in hydrodynamics, and what you will find is that, well, take, for example, the longitudinal pressure here, okay, that starting at a state where the system is highly anisotropic, the transverse pressure is almost twice the longitudinal pressure here, hydrodynamics actually describes the dynamics of the system or the further evolution of the pressure extremely well, okay? So it actually seems to apply under conditions that perhaps naively you didn't anticipate, namely when essentially both of your expansion parameters are of order one, right? So the pressure anisotropy is of order one, and actually the time that's shown here, you can also interpret as kind of a ratio of the mean free path over the relevant scale of gradients in the system. So that's also of order one. And so there's really a surprising effectiveness of viscous hydrodynamics, okay, in describing the evolution of macroscopic properties of the system. Okay, and this is nothing that's, you know, you may argue here now, okay, good, you're taking your weak coupling calculation, maybe you're pushing this a little bit too far, okay, but this is nothing that's sort of unique to these kind of microscopic calculations in QCD kinetic theory. These patterns have also been observed, for instance, in strong coupling systems and various other models that you can study in this context. Now, the other thing that you can ask is, okay, well, if you believe that you can start using hydrodynamics on the time scale of one equilibrium relaxation time, what would this mean for heavy ion phenomenology? Okay. And what it would mean is that, well, okay, if you assume you can use hydrodynamics on the scale of an equilibrium relaxation time, then whatever that time scale is depends on the viscosity of your system and the typical temperature that you have in your system. You can estimate this from experiment, and indeed what you will come out with is a time scale that's on the order of one Fermi or so, which is very much in line with what previously we had learned from just looking at the outcome of experiments and trying to describe. Okay, so we can take this a little bit further. And so what one can actually now do is that one understands this both on the microscopic and the macroscopic level, one can sort of try to actually put this into models, okay? And it's now possible to really, so taking this technology, take this and really describe, try to describe a heavy ion collision from beginning to end. And so here's an example of evolution of pressures where something like this was done. So there we really started with a period where you have energy deposition. This is using classical fields description for the strong fields created initially in the collision, then passing this to kinetic theory and passing this to hydrodynamics, okay? And you kind of see a smooth transition between all of this. So the bottom line is here with this kind of theoretical progress, we can try to describe this beginning to end. However, now you may ask the question, okay, so what, okay? So what? Because it turns out that actually, so this is of course important on a conceptual level to kind of start to resolve this theoretical question, right? But it turns out that the actual effects in the simulation of including their pre-equilibrium phase are relatively small, okay? And this is naturally understood, okay? Because we're dealing with dynamics that sort of happens on the time scale of Fermi over C also, whereas the whole collision lasts something like 10 Fermi over C. So it's simply just a very, very short period of time that we're dealing with. And if we just look at the overall expansion dynamics, then naturally we will not learn very much about this early pre-equilibrium stage. So this is good news and bad news, okay? It's good news if you just want to learn about properties of the quark-gluon plasma in thermal equilibrium, then it means there are no large uncertainties coming from this much harder to describe pre-equilibrium stage, okay? And that's why we've been able to describe these experiments for a long time without really knowing what's going on here. However, if you're a person like me, okay, which is really excited about this stuff, okay, it's bad news in the sense that it also becomes much, much harder to probe what is really going on in this pre-equilibrium stage. How much time do I have left, actually? 2 minutes, okay. Okay, 5 minutes is fine. Okay, so of course, now that we understand it, we want to say, okay, are there actually ways that we can probe this? Okay, and it turns out there are, and there are sort of are ways that go along different directions. Okay, and so the three that I could come up with so far, okay, evolve around different ideas. Okay, so and the first chance that you may have is okay. You continue to look at heavy ion collisions, okay? But now you look at some property of the system, okay, that is really sensitive. I mean, that only changes during the time when the system is out of equilibrium and is essentially no longer changing once the system has thermalized and undergoes the further expansion, okay? Something like that exists. It's actually related to entropy production and it's also observed. The other thing that you can do is you can say, well, okay, if I'm bothered by this long-lived hydrodynamics phase, is there any way that I can try to cut this shorter? Okay. And indeed, there is a way to do so by instead of colliding very, very large nuclei, okay, you try to collide smaller nuclei or even just protons with another nucleus. Okay. In this case, you create a much smaller system. The much smaller system expands. Starts to expand much more rapidly in the transverse direction. Thereby, the system can simply sort of fall apart before it has completely equilibrated. Now, this is a great way to enhance the effects of the pre-equilibrium of the non-equilibrium dynamics. Okay, the problem is that there's other complications that you run into. So this is a very, very active area of research, both theoretically and experimentally. But I think it's nothing that's sort of finally resolved. Okay. The final thing that you can do, and maybe I'll only pick up on that point, is that you can actually exploit the fact. So far we've looked at, you know, I've showed you pictures of kind of all the produced hadrons in the heavy ion collisions. Okay, but this is not all that's going on, right? So heavy ion collisions are really also like neutron star mergers or anything, right? They are multi-messenger experiments. Okay, so in addition to producing a bunch of hadrons, you also produce sometimes very high energy particles, or you also produce a lot of electromagnetic radiations, leptons, and so forth. And these are really different probes in the sense that they allow you to look with a more calibrated eye at different stages of the collision. So let me skip this and let me tell you about one thing that I'm particularly excited about, which is that we may actually have a chance to look at this very early stages by looking at the production of electron positron or mu plus mu minus pairs, which are, so this is what I call a dilepton. So why is this useful? Okay, so you may ask, okay, so why are you now starting to talk about electromagnetic probes? So the key difference is here. So what can happen is that, you know, your quarks and gluons interact and they produce, say, an electron positron pair. Okay? The point is that this electron positron pair, once produced, will not very strongly interact with the rest of the plasma and it will therefore just fly out. So if I can tune the kinematics of this lepton pair such that it's predominantly produced during the early stages, I get a direct eye into what is going on. Okay. And so the way that this happens is at leading order, mainly to the annihilation of quarks and antiquarks. You have a photon that splits into a lepton. Okay. And so, of course, your quarks and antiquarks, they need to provide the energy for this lepton pair. So initially the plasma is very hot. You have lots and lots of energy. You can produce very high energy dileptons, but later when the plasma cools down, the energy is simply no longer available and the production is exponentially suppressed. Okay. And so if you look at the spectrum of the dileptons that you produce as a function of the invariant mass, looking here, so for instance, at the blue line, you can break this up into a contribution that comes from the early non-equilibrium phase and a contribution that comes from the time when hydrodynamics is applicable. And you can see that, okay, once you go above a certain mass threshold, which is somewhere in the GeV range, the pre-equilibrium stage starts to dominate. Now, there's also a contribution where you produce dileptons from just smashing the nuclei into each other. So this is trying to estimate it here in these dashed lines. And so at the end of the day, you can find a window where essentially the pre-equilibrium thing is supposed to win over both the contribution from smashing the nuclei, this is called the Drellian, as well as over the later stage thermal radiation that you have. Now, this is something that to this extent has not been measured because there's a huge background there, but this is something that will be accessible with the next generation of heavy ion experiments like RDS3 or the LHCb upgrade for, I think, round 5 at the LHC. Okay, so with that, let me wrap up. So in this talk, I tried to convince you that by studying these high energy heavy ion collisions, we have a very unique environment that allows us not only to explore the structure, but also the very rich dynamics of fundamental constituents of matter under very, very extreme conditions, where we really see them in free, so to say. A big puzzle has been to understand the non-equilibrium dynamical properties of these things, okay? And so there's been significant progress in understanding both the early time dynamics of these collisions, but also more in general, the thermalization patterns of non-abelian gauge theories such as QCD. So we've established the basic thermalization mechanisms that you have, and we've learned a lot of things about what it means to apply a hydrodynamic description to non-equilibrium systems. And there's exciting prospects to further explore properties of both the initial state and non-equilibrium dynamics with future experiments, like I just showed in the case of dileptons. Okay, with that, thank you very much.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
So the mystery here where the whole community is fighting with is hydrodynamization also, mm-hmm. not only thermalization, as you emphasized here also. And here you mentioned local equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
However, the corrections you mentioned were local non-equilibrium systems. I mean, local non-equilibrium descriptions, let's say higher order hydrodynamics is local non-equilibrium. Mm-hmm. However, we are in an Institute of Solid State Physics. And here there is a well-known other example of non-local equilibrium systems, the so-called, for example, superfluid superconductors at the background. And those are hydrodynamic systems in a very strict sense, still somehow not look, we are not like to look them as hydrodynamics because they have also a wave function representation, so-called macroscopic Bose condensates. Mm-hmm. So my question is whether something indicates like non-local equilibrium in quark-gluon plasma, or anybody corresponds this kind of extension or not?
I don't. So out of the top of my head, I don't think that anything like that has been studied. Maybe one of the things one should mention in this context is that kind of, you know, for all of the things that I'm that I've been showing, right? I mean, these are incredibly complicated calculations, right? So like it took us 20 years to even develop the infrastructure to solve this. So typically when we solve these equations, we actually solve them under very restricted symmetry assumptions, right? Like we consider particular conditions of flow where, I mean, some examples were effectively zero plus three dimensional or something like this. Yeah. So in that sense, I'm not sure whether with the technology that sort of has been looked at, one could even sort of try to look at these questions, right? I mean, distinguish local versus global, or local versus non-local phenomena.
In my mind was also that Bose condensation is related to non-trivial statistical, I mean, non-Maxwell-Boltzmann, not Euchner-like mm-hmm. statistics, and people are looking for these.
So people have looked at
refined statistical descriptions and the physics behind that.
The question whether you can have condensation phenomena in these non-abelian gauge theories is also something that people looked at something like, I don't know, when I was a PhD student, so maybe 10 years ago or so. But let's put it like, it was basically concluded that the question didn't really make so much sense, okay? Because the problem is to have a meaningful definition of a condensate, you need a gauge invariant operator, right, in QCD, right? And it was basically found that whenever you write down a gauge invariant operator, there's not gonna be a condensate, okay? So, Now, does that mean there cannot be anything? No, I mean, maybe it just hasn't been found, okay? But like so there's many contexts where we've also done non-perturbative field calculations and compared them to essentially recoupling techniques in kinetic theory, okay? And there's no, even under conditions where you have very high occupation numbers, where usually if you consider any kind of system condensation phenomena would occur and it wouldn't happen, okay? So it's just simply, it doesn't appear to be at least very important in non-abelian gauge theories. That was my conclusion.
Understood. No indication. Okay.
Yeah. Simple.
Any questions from the internet? Nobody? Questions here. Peter.
Statement of yours, you said that there's no quantum field theory for non-equilibrium interacting fields, quantum fields, there is no systematic theory or something like this. And there is one, it's the Keldysh-Green function theory has an extension to path integrals. So at least in very simple cases of bosonic fields, but also for fermionic fields, that one can attack the problem of open quantum systems, driven ones, dissipative ones, non-trivial phase-space distributions can be calculated systematically.
Thanks for pointing out. Of course, I know this, right? I mean, what I meant by the statement, right, is of course you can. I mean, of course you can write down your Schwinger-Keldysh path integral, right, or perform the quantization. The point is, like for static quantities, you could do a Monte Carlo simulations in many cases and just solve that. I mean, just calculate the partition function or solve that path integral exactly, right? Generically, this is not possible for any kind of real-time dynamics process, right, because of the sign problem, right? So after that, no matter what you do, I mean, unless you can actually compute the path integral, which you can only if the theory is non-interacting typically, right? You have to deal with some kind of approximate method. That's what I mean. So I meant no exact way, right, to do that. Now, I mean, there may be very good ways, right? I mean, in low-dimensional systems, right, you have quasi-exact or even exact methods, right? But generally, it's a hard problem, right? And
a partly technical question, but also a physical question. You mentioned the lepton pair production. Mm-hmm. I remember that this was a very hot topic already at CERN SPS experiments. It was lots of calculation. Of course, that was the chiral symmetry restoration and how mm-hmm. that can be cached in the lepton pair spectra. So now you said that you are interested in it. So what was not measured at RIC on the lepton spectra, which now you think that it is even remain interesting in this time?
So what remains interesting and what has never been, what has never been measured is the background subtracted part at high invariant mass. So if you talk about properties of chiral symmetry restoration also, then this is something which you would see in modifications of spectral functions of, say, the rho or so. Yeah? So this is somewhere sitting way down here, right? I mean, the beauty about these lepton pairs is they're very, very versatile probes in general, right? You have this invariant mass that you can control, and thereby you can look at different physics with them. You can even use them as kind of quote-unquote ersatz photons, right? So the point is that typically if you look at this invariant mass range here, which is sort of on the order of the GeV scale, you get a lot of contributions from heavy flavor decays. And this outshines, I mean, the signal to background, if you just estimate from knowing how many heavy flavor hadrons are there and what this yield is like a factor 1 to 100, okay? Now you can distinguish this by looking at, because they decay, so the charm decays, which are dominant here, happen after the finite lifetime of the charm, right? So they're displaced from the original point, but you need very high pointing resolutions to identify this, and this has not been achieved.
But if you have, so at now the new measurement will detect the charm and bottom production.
Yeah, so this
somehow,
is
somehow maybe those, how would I say, this heavy quark contribution in the background. So you think, you expect that will not match, will not shadowing the thermal or how the primordial
you have to be able to suppress this with the confidence of, or with a 1%, with less than a percent error, right? But talking to experimentalists who are, you know, who are thinking about how to do this, they believe they can do this, right? Uh-huh. Yeah,
I see.
It's not easy, right? This is why it's never been done. You're looking for a 1% signal on top of a background which is 100 times bigger, but which in principle, if you could, you know, if you had a very, very good calorimeter or a very, very good tracker, you could measure, right? And you could subtract exactly. So you just need to do it very precisely. Yeah? And this is also why usually sometimes these things are subtracted by just, you know, looking at statistical mixtures of particles produced. This is, you're probably not going to do this cocktail subtraction here down to this precision. This is why you really need the detector-based suppression of this.
In some sense, these are events, the precision measurement of the quark gluon plasma studies.
Yeah.
Okay, another question.
Yeah. So if I understood correctly, part of the motivation for your work was to understand something about the very first stages of the evolution of the universe. Pre-expansion or
the question that's relevant in the context of the early universe is the picture is, you know, you have the period of inflation, right? And then after inflation, sort of all energy is in the inflaton field, right? But then by the time that Big Bang nucleosynthesis happens, right, you need to produce standard model matter, right? And the question is in a thermalized form, actually, right? So the question is, how do you, so in one way or the other, the inflaton will have to inject energy into the standard model, and then you can ask all these questions, right? Like, how does the standard model thermalize? In which order does this happen, right? It's a very interesting, just kind of, you know, non-equilibrium statistical mechanics question, right? So for non-abelian, so if you just have QCD or just non-abelian gauge theories, we understand this now. But of course, there's also a lot of physics just in the different interplays of, say the weak sector and the strong sector, right? So that I think still remains to be done. I mean, the technology in principle is the same, it's just more work.
And you also mentioned that there are only few observables which are influenced by these effects in regular heavy ion collisions.
Mm-hmm.
And this dilepton production is maybe one of these few observables mm-hmm. at large invariant mass. So what about the early universe? What observables would be explained by, as a result of your work?
Well, okay, I mean, first thing I should say is I haven't done any work in that direction yet. we have looked into this a little bit, right? And so, and looked at a few papers there. So, I mean, it's the typical things really, right? So you could say, well, okay, good. The system stays out of equilibrium. Maybe this is something I can use for baryogenesis, right? Or you could say, okay, I have these very highly energetic particles somehow present due to the coupling with the inflaton. Is this something I can use to do dark matter production or something like this, right? So these are like the typical, these are like the typical things that that have been mentioned. Effects on expansion dynamics also are much, are also there, I think, much less significant, because typically, I mean, typically you expect the standard model thermalization to be relatively fast on the time scale of injecting energy into the standard model. That's typically, I think, what happens in these kind of theories. Although you can violate this also, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And also gravity matters there, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Gravity matters. So, yeah, yeah.
Maybe another question for me. So you are speaking about thermalization by viscosity. And actually, all these hydro models are based on viscosity thermalization. What about heat conduction?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, okay, so for so for heat conduction, you need finite baryon density, right? I mean, or you need a finite. No, so wait, so let me not let me get this straight. Yeah, well, I mean, for heat conduction, certainly you need inhomogeneities, right? Otherwise, there is no heat conduction, and the examples of the calculation I've shown here don't have inhomogeneities. Now the question is, I mean, the question could be is if you relax these symmetry restricted assumptions instead of more dimensional, I mean, so having including the transverse expansion and so forth, right? Then you could ask the question. We've done first calculations of this, but not using QCD yet. We're using simpler models. So there one could investigate these questions, for instance, right? Like which kind of hydrodynamic theories, for instance, describe things better or worse, right? Yeah, the ones which include heat conduction as a phenomenon or not, right? So, yeah, but this is nothing that's, I think, really been looked at.
If there are no more questions, neither from the internet, then let me. Sorry. Thanks, Søren, the presentation, and let me present some presents. First of all, I would like to give you a portrait of Eugène Wigner as a medal and to remember your Wigner colloquium.
Very nice.
And some other smaller and larger objects. Not immediate, but later. Okay.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
So, thank you for the presentation and coming here. And again, let us ask. Thank Søren for the nice presentation.
Yeah, thank you. It's really, really a pleasure.